Before I get started with today's show, I want to take a quick and personal moment to tell you about someone named Aaron Chambers. Aaron Chambers was one of my most loyal listeners. She was a member of my Court Junkie discussion group, and she even created a subreddit for Court Junkie. She created a space where listeners could go and discuss the episodes in a civilized, structured, and fun way. Well, I recently received the news that Aaron has passed away at the age of just 28. I want to let her family know that I appreciate and am so honored that Aaron even listened to my podcast, let alone was such a loyal listener. I am so very sorry for your loss, and may Aaron's memory live on forever. Today's episode is dedicated to Aaron Chambers. It was just after 12:40 p.m. on March 20th, 2012, and 77-year-old Rudolfo Miana, who was in very poor health, was giving a videotaped deposition from his home. Miana was a military veteran from the Philippines who had come to the United States in 1997 and who was now living in Las Vegas. He was seated in a large recliner chair with a female interpreter seated directly adjacent to him. Miana listened intently as the prosecutor asked him questions, through his interpreter, about what should have been a routine medical procedure he underwent 5 years earlier, in 2007. He told the prosecutor, Chief Deputy District Attorney Pam Weckerly, that in September of 2007, his doctor referred him for a colonoscopy. His wife drove him to the appointment, and he checked in at the Endoscopy Center of Southern Nevada. He doesn't remember how long he waited in the waiting room, but afterwards, he was taken to another room where he changed into a gown and was given an IV. He was told he would have to wait a while, and at some point after, someone came in and told him that he was ready for his procedure. He was sedated through the IV and fell asleep. When he woke up, he changed back into his clothes. When asked if anyone checked his blood pressure after the procedure, he said no. He was told by one of the females working there that his results were normal. He was then discharged, and his son-in-law arrived to pick him up. About a month later, he said he started getting diarrhea. His skin started turning yellow, and he was experiencing other flu-like symptoms, along with some sort of slight depression. He went to see another doctor, who ordered blood tests. Weckerly asked if he was told what the results of his blood tests were, and he said yes. He was told that he had tested positive for hepatitis C. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 70. The first sign that anything was amiss at the Endoscopy Center of Southern Nevada was in January of 2008, when the Southern Nevada Health District started an investigation into the center itself. They had received two reports of patients who had contracted hepatitis C, and the common denominator between the two patients was that they had both been patients at the Endoscopy Center. By February 2008, that number had grown to six patients who had contracted hepatitis C, five of whom had had procedures at the Endoscopy Center on the same day, in September of 2007. The normal amount of reports of hepatitis C were about two a year, so this many in such a short time set off red flags to health officials. The health district joined forces with the Nevada State Bureau of Licensure and Certification and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the conclusion of their investigation was that the outbreak was due to, quote, unsafe injection practices that were reported by staff members, identified in clinical documentation, and observed by investigators. The reuse of syringes to access vials of propofol, and the vials were then reused for subsequent patients, transmitting any contamination to those patients. In other words, nurses had been reusing syringes and single-dose medicine vials on multiple patients. A letter was sent out to more than 60,000 prior patients of the center, recommending that if any of them had received injected sedatives at the center any time from March 2004 through January of 2008, they should get tested for hepatitis C, hepatitis B, and HIV. The Endoscopy Center responded once the investigation was made public, holding a news conference in which three of the center's physicians stood in front of reporters and read a statement, saying in part, "On behalf of the Endoscopy Center of Southern Nevada, We want to express our deep concern about this incident to the many patients who have put their trust in us over the years. As always, our patients remain our primary responsibility, and we have already corrected the situation. They said their attorneys would not allow them to answer any questions. Notably absent from the news conference was the medical director and majority owner of the center, Dr. Deepak Desai. Dr. Desai was a relatively well-known physician in the area. Originally from India, he had moved to the United States in the 1970s. After practicing medicine in New York, he settled in Las Vegas in the 1980s, where he served on the Nevada Board of Medical Examiners, and then was the medical director for gastroenterology at both the University Medical Center and the Valley Hospital Medical Center. Dr. Desai opened up the Endoscopy Center in 2004 and also founded the Gastroenterology Center of Nevada, which has 6 locations, one of which is located in the same office as the Endoscopy Center. Not long after their press conference, the city of Las Vegas issued an emergency suspension of the center's business license, along with the other centers owned by Dr. Desai, meaning they could no longer operate and had to be shut down. Dr. Desai filed an appeal, but it was denied just days later. In March 2008, things took another bad turn for the Endoscopy Center. The FBI, along with the Nevada Attorney General, announced their investigations into its practices. On March 10, 2008, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police executed a search warrant on the center, seizing hundreds of boxes of records. Investigators also interviewed staff members and potential infected patients. And what they found out about the center's practices was horrifying. It was officially the largest hepatitis C scare in the United States, as the number of possibly affected patients grew, and Dr. Desai and his clinic seemed to be right in the middle of it. Although he didn't voluntarily surrender his license, the Nevada Board of Medical Examiners obtained a temporary restraining order, which kept him from seeing any patients. They also filed a complaint against him. According to a final 266-page report issued by the Southern Nevada Health District in December of 2009, quote, certified registered nurse anesthetists were observed reusing syringes on one patient, reusing propofol vials for multiple patients, reported being directed to do so, and reported routinely doing so. After a lengthy criminal investigation, charges were filed against Dr. Desai and two of his nurse anesthetists, Ronald Lakeman and Keith Mathis. Among the charges stemming from the outbreak were racketeering, criminal neglect of patients resulting in substantial bodily harm, and reckless endangerment resulting in substantial bodily harm. But while they were awaiting trial on those charges, in August of 2012, an additional charge each of second-degree murder was added. One of the infected patients, Rudolfo Miana, who I told you about earlier in the episode, had passed away due to complications from hepatitis C. According to the indictment, Dr. Desai, Lakeman, and Mathis were charged with second-degree murder, quote, for their criminal neglect and reckless disregard for patients, resulting in Miana's infection and ultimately his death. Lakeman and Mathis were both accused of injecting the source patients on the days that they were infected. In addition to the state charges, Dr. Desai was also the subject of a federal investigation for possible Medicare and insurance fraud negligence. Some staff members told reporters that the center often overbilled for anesthesia given to patients. Meanwhile, approximately 5,000 former patients filed a lawsuit against the center. A jury awarded $500 million in damages against Health Plan of Nevada and Sierra Health Services, which tied a state record. Dr. Desai was also ordered to pay an undisclosed amount. Since his arrest, Dr. Desai's attorneys had argued to the judge that Dr. Desai was in such poor health due to 3 strokes he had suffered since his indictments that he should be declared unfit for trial. Prosecutors argued against this, alleging that he was faking or exaggerating his illnesses in order to avoid going to trial. He was ordered to undergo a mental evaluation 3 different times. The first two times, he was declared incompetent to stand trial. But the third time, in September of 2011, doctors concluded that he was fit to go to trial. By the time the trial began in May of 2013, Keith Mathis ended up pleading guilty to five charges, including criminal neglect of patients resulting in death, insurance fraud, and conspiracy to commit racketeering. He agreed to testify against his co-defendants, Dr. Desai and Ronald Lakeman, who would be tried together during the same trial. By then, authorities had been able to definitively link seven hepatitis C cases to Dr. Desai's endoscopy centers, although more than 100 others were reportedly indirectly affected. Some other witnesses expected to testify were staff members of the endoscopy center, who were granted immunity in exchange for their testimony. In his opening statement, Chief Deputy District Attorney Mike Stadaher told the jury that Dr. Desai ran his endoscopy center like an assembly line and said that he was pinching pennies while risking the health and safety of his patients.
Cattle, they were moved through there like cattle. It was an assembly line. The patient load, the pressure of patients coming in and out, over and on and around every aspect of the practice. Triple booking, double booking, patients. This isn't an airline, ladies and gentlemen. This is a medical care facility, or was. The fact that these are the terms that the staff at the facility were using about what was going on at the clinic should give you some insight as to what was going on.
He said Dr. Desai was booking so many patients that they were performing more than 60 procedures a day. He said the staff got so used to their unsafe injection practices that they did it right in front of CDC investigators who came to observe the clinic before its shutdown in early 2008. He told the jury about the letter that was sent out to more than 63,000 patients.
63,000 patients, 3.4% of the population of Clark County. Translated into families where people are, that's 9.4% of the entire family population of Clark County. Had a family member that was involved or got letters in some way, was directly touched by what happened at that clinic. 63,000 patients were notified. As of the date of this outbreak occurring, there had been 33 prior outbreaks of hepatitis B and hepatitis C in the country. 33. This outbreak eclipsed all others, meaning it was the largest of all others. As a matter of fact, you will hear that not only was it the largest, but there were more patients involved in this, more patients exposed to the hepatitis C virus in this one single event at that clinic than in all 33 prior outbreaks combined. It resulted in the largest patient notification in U.S. history.
He described how Dr. Desai was intent on saving money, how he was laser-like focused on cost. He said things like disposable forceps and syringes designed for single use would be reused multiple times. The term single use was printed clearly on the packages, but that term wasn't in their vernacular, he said. And single-use vials of propofol were reused too, all at the direction of Dr. Desai. He showed the jury a photo of Rodolfo Miana and said he died a horrible and regrettable death after contracting hepatitis C at Dr. Desai's center.
In our society, the entirety of the medical care system is based on trust. You have to be able to trust your doctor. You have to be able to put your life in that doctor's hands or those healthcare providers' hands if they are such that they can do things like put you to sleep and then do something to you, cut you open and operate on you. You have to be reliant on the fact that they will do the right thing, that they will not, in a sense, put you and your condition aside and look upon you as a commodity. A commodity. That's all you are in that clinic. And everybody knew about it. Everybody was complicit. Those individuals who were charged were directly related and associated with the death of Mr. Miana and the infections caused to those patients who have been charged in this case.
In his opening statement, Richard Wright, the attorney for Dr. Desai, told the jury that he was confident that it would not find any criminal wrongdoing at the endoscopy center. He said testimony will show that the nurses and physicians who worked at the center did not believe that they were endangering their patients. And in order to convict either Dr. Desai or Ronald Lakeman, they must find that they knew their conduct would cause harm to their patients.
I'm not even sure. It's going to be interesting to see with CDC and Southern Nevada Health District. I'm not even sure we're going to be able to get to proving exactly what the transmission mechanism was that day, which is what's necessary for us to determine who was at fault and whether or not they knew they were at fault at the time they were doing it.
The attorney for Ronald Lakeman, Rick Santa Croce, told the jury that prosecutors would have a hard time proving that patients were infected due to unsafe injection practices. Instead, he said testimony will show that the infections could have been transmitted through a number of other ways, like poorly cleaned endoscopy scopes or saline contamination. He also asked them to consider why the other nurse anesthetists and physicians at the center weren't charged. 72-year-old Michael Washington was one of the first witnesses to take the stand. He testified that Dr. Desai performed a colonoscopy on him in July of 2007. He said a few weeks later, he noticed that his eyes were turning yellow, he was losing weight, and he was experiencing abdominal pain accompanied by dark urine. He was diagnosed with hepatitis C. He said he now has trouble eating and walking and has to have fluid drained from his abdomen every week due to his liver malfunctioning. Michael's wife also testified. She told the jury that Dr. Desai destroyed her husband's life and that he now spends most of his time seeing specialists. He's not the man that he was before this happened, she said. On cross-examination, both Michael and his wife acknowledged that they had received a $25.4 million settlement after filing a lawsuit against Dr. Desai and his center. Stacy Hutchison testified that she, too, contracted hepatitis C from the center back in September of 2007. After her colonoscopy, she started feeling flu-like symptoms, too, and began dropping weight. She had some blood work done, and the results were that her liver enzymes were through the roof. She was then admitted to the hospital and had to stay there for 2.5 weeks. She still had her flu-like symptoms, and her eyes turned yellow. She said she had more blood tests done, ultrasounds, and an MRI, and that they still couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. They finally decided to do a liver biopsy, and that's when she was told that she had hepatitis C. She began crying on the stand as she recalled how someone from the health district gave her the news.
When you found out and you got that call from the health district, you were still in the hospital?
Yes, I was.
Okay, and so no doctor had even talked to you at that point?
No.
Okay, so you get this call. Does some doctor ever come and explain what their findings were to you?
No, I didn't find out from the doctor till the next morning. And when the health district calls you, they ask you questions that are disgusting because I've always been a clean person. So when you get that call and they ask you, you know, do you have any tattoos? Do you have any piercings? Have you been out of the country? How many sex partners do you have? Do you...
Objection or hearsay?
You don't understand. It made me feel like I was a dirty person.
She said she was devastated and had no idea how she had contracted hepatitis C. She did some research and saw that it could be contracted by needles, and the only place she had been with needles was at the endoscopy center. Her primary doctor told her to follow up at the endoscopy center, so she went and met with Dr. Desai.
What is the discussion about your situation? What does he say?
He said that my vital signs were going down and that the hepatitis C looked like it was clearing itself up and that I was in an acute stage.
That and, you were or were not in an acute stage?
Oh, then I'm in an acute stage.
So yes, acute?
Yes, acute.
Okay.
When I freaked out in his office.
Okay, because... I think I know what freaked out means, but describe what you mean by that.
Hysterically crying, wondering how I got this, where it came from.
And what does he do?
And he said that he would get his boss, Dr. Carroll, to come in and explain to me better on my situation with my blood work, and Dr. Carroll didn't do any better, so I was still hysterically crying.
Okay, and so as you're there crying and upset, he says he's going to go get his boss,
Dr. Carroll.
Dr. Carroll to come talk to you?
Yeah.
Does he leave the room?
He leaves the room, yeah, because...
Were you by yourself?
Yeah, Dr. Desai guaranteed me that my hepatitis C would go away.
On cross-examination, Stacy told the court that she had received $4.1 million in civil settlements, but that most of that money would be going towards future medical bills. Yuri Kadiakov from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta testified that he's absolutely certain that the patients in question who contracted hepatitis C got it after having procedures done at the endoscopy center. There were two clusters of patients from July 2007 and September 2007. He testified that the strains on the two dates are not the same, but the strains of the infected patients and the source patients on each date are nearly identical. Dr. Thomas Yi is an anesthesiologist who testified that at one point he started negotiations with Dr. Desai to oversee the nurse anesthetist at the endoscopy center. He told the jury that he provided anesthesia services to Dr. Desai about once every 6 months from about 1996 to 2001. At some point after that, he and Dr. Desai came up with a proposal. He would do a pre-medical interview with each patient, would monitor the patient post-procedure, and would physically supervise the nurse anesthetist at the center. But he said it was mostly just talk, and they never finalized anything. A document was shown to the jury. It was a letter of agreement to supervise, and it was signed with a signature that Dr. Yi told the jury wasn't his. He was asked if at any point he ever supervised any anesthetists at Dr. Desai's center, and he said no, he never did. Jean Scambio testified that she started working as a discharge nurse at the endoscopy center in January of 2006. She said she worked there for approximately 5 months, and that was all she could handle because of how the facility was run. As part of her duties as a discharge nurse, they would have her go over the results with the patients, something she said she wasn't comfortable doing. She said on occasion there were results that didn't look good, and she didn't feel as though she should be the one to tell the patient about possible tumors.
What was the atmosphere like at the clinic during the time you were there?
It was very fast-paced, very stressful. There was always roomfuls of patients. Like, the waiting room was always very full. Patients were angry about how long they had to wait to come in, get out. It just wasn't a nice atmosphere.
She said patients would be moved through quickly. She didn't feel comfortable there and felt like the place was unsafe. Too many patients moving through and the procedures were too quick. Keith Mathis, the third co-defendant who had pleaded guilty in exchange for his testimony, then took the stand. He testified that when they first opened, they would take about 40 patients a day, and then their numbers almost doubled to about 60 to 80 patients a day.
Was there any issue of scheduling more patients than you physically could do? And what I mean by that is double booking or triple booking or anything like that. Were you ever aware that that was going on?
Yes.
Is that a regular occurrence on a daily basis?
As far as I remember, it was pretty much because patients were complaining a lot about sitting so long waiting to have their procedures done, yes.
Describing his day-to-day experience, he said he never saw any cleaning of the rooms between patients. He said that was because sometimes there would be less than a minute before the next patient would come in. He said because there were so many patients, he didn't have any time to leave the room to talk to them after their procedures. He was asked if he was ever pressured to move patient interviews before their procedures along, and he said, all the time, by Dr. Desai. He was asked if he knows who Thomas Yi is, and he said, no, he does not. He said he heard the name Yi mentioned before, but that Thomas Yi never supervised them. He recalled when the center started using propofol for their anesthesia. He said he suggested it because the stuff that they were using was taking a long time for the patients to recover. but propofol would sometimes be too quick, and patients would often wake up during the procedures and need more. But even so, he was instructed not to give any additional doses.
Did you have situations like that where patients began to wake up and move and you felt that they needed, as a clinician, additional medication to put them under?
Yes, I did.
In those situations, were you ever told not to give any medication?
Yes, I was.
Who told you not to do that in those instances?
Dr. Desai had been the one.
Did that happen on a regular basis?
I would say yes, it did, yes.
So patient, in fact, just so we've got a clear picture of this, patient, in your opinion, needs additional medication to have a safe, comfortable procedure?
It wouldn't happen every time, but it would happen quite regularly, yes.
But in your opinion, was that something that was, as the person doing the anesthesia, something you would have normally given to the patient?
Yes, I might have, should have done it, and a lot of times I did give it without him knowing it, yes, just to keep the patient, you know, in a sedated state.
Did he ever see you doing that and then yell at you for doing it?
Yes.
Was that also something that happened fairly often?
Could happen frequently, yes.
I mean, we're not talking about isolated events, are we?
No.
He was shown an anesthesia form that would then be sent to the insurance companies, where the anesthesia times for the patients were inflated. He told the jury that they were instructed to always enter the times at 30 minutes or greater, even if the procedures didn't last that long. It was something that was emphatically explained to him by Dr. Desai when he first started working there. He said he never questioned it and doesn't remember ever refusing to do it. He had never done that before in his career. Mathis was then asked about certain supplies at the center, including 10 milliliter syringes that were used to administer the anesthesia.
Now, are these the, I mean, are you familiar with the use of these in the clinic?
Yes.
Where were they used?
That's what we use for anesthesia. We would draw up our propofol in those, or any other medication that you might need to give would all be drawn up in this type of a syringe.
So you didn't have larger ones for that purpose, 20 cc syringes, anything like that?
No, we never had any.
Did you ever request any?
Yes.
Who did you request those to?
Probably our supervisors, and we turned down.
So do you know why?
I'm sure it was cost factoring.
Do you know, did you ever talk to Dr. Desai about this specifically?
I probably did. I don't recall specifically, but I probably did because it's just made more sense to use the 20 milliliter than this one.
Regarding other supplies, he said they were not allowed to waste anything.
The propofol, for one of the things, was absolutely something that was forbidden to waste. Syringes, I mean, angiocast, anything like that. If we had to re-stick someone because we missed the vein or somebody had missed the vein, you know, or something like that, that would be considered a waste. And we would be talked to about it.
Who would talk to you about it?
Well, if Dr. D was there and saw it, he would be talking to us about it.
And what would his tone be when he was talking to you about it?
Angry.
He said Dr. Desai would get so angry at them if they couldn't get an IV in or if they were taking too long that he would then take over.
Can you describe for me any instances that you had where Dr. Desai may have intervened in that situation?
Yes, he would give you about one chance to do it, and if you didn't do it, he would grab the needle and try and do it himself or proceed to do it himself and then just leave the blood running out while we try and get the pour down so we can go ahead and tape it and get the patient sedated.
So you tell me he would insert the device into the vein and then just walk away?
Yes.
And when this has been inserted into the patient, now that's in communication with the bloodstream, correct?
That's right.
So what is happening to the patient's blood during this time?
Running on the arm and running on us, trying to get the pour down and get it stopped.
He said Dr. Desai was also strict about not using very much KY jelly on the scopes for the colonoscopies.
So, KY jelly, let's talk about that stuff. What is it used for?
Lubricant on the scope.
Is it necessary to have that stuff on the scope to use it?
It would certainly make the scope slide a lot easier.
And one of the issues that when the scopes are going in, you're trying not to perforate an intestine or something.
Correct.
So, and also patient comfort, I would imagine?
Yes.
So when the situation is that he's giving the techs a hard time about using too much KY jelly, what is he talking about? Don't squirt as much on, or what was he doing?
They would place it on a 4x4, and he would watch how much it was placed on the 4x4, yes.
He would actually watch that and comment about how much was on the 4x4?
Oh, yes. If there was too much, they would know very much about it.
He said Dr. Desai wanted to save money on propofol, and he would frequently start procedures even before patients were sedated.
Now, you said that Dr. Desai was really fixated on propofol at one point.
Yes, very much.
Can you tell us about that?
I don't remember the year again, but it was came up when they felt, or he felt, that we were using too much propofol, and that instead of injecting, if we needed to give more propofol, we should just inject some saline to flush the catheter, and what little bit would be in there would go into the patient.
So if I understand you correctly, I'm showing again Exhibit 72B, that little tiny needle or sheath over the needle would contain some propofol at
yes.
the end when
yes.
you injected it.
Yes.
And instead of you giving more propofol to a patient, he instructed you to actually flush that out with saline?
Yes.
He specifically said
yes.
That. With regard to propofol again, were you ever in a room with Dr. Desai when a patient was starting to wake up, move around during the procedure?
Yes.
In normal situations that you had been in, what would you do in that instance?
Give the patient more anesthetic, more propofol.
Would Desai allow you to do that?
Most times, no, would not.
So the patient is actually now writhing around or moving around on the table, and you feel it's appropriate to give more anesthesia, and he won't let you do it?
Yes.
What about the other end of the operation, before the patient's, when I say operation, it was a colonoscopy or an upperdoscopy, correct?
Correct.
Before the patients are anesthetized, you're back there, you're either doing your form or you're getting ready to do it. Are you with me?
Yes.
You have not yet given anesthesia. Did Desai ever start procedures before the patient had anesthesia on board?
Yes, he did.
How did the patients react to that?
Look at us for help.
And he would just continue?
Continue, and we'd try and give the anesthetic as fast as we could.
In those instances, is the patient moving around when you're trying to give the anesthetic?
Yes.
Is it something that he wasn't aware that the patient was awake? Still?
He was very much aware.
Did you tell him that I haven't given anesthesia yet?
That's right.
What would he do?
Continue on. Just give it.
He said this happened quite frequently, roughly about 10 times in a typical week. The prosecutor then asked more about the end of the procedures and about a shocking practice that Dr. Desai engaged in.
Did you observe the scopes coming out of the patients? Meaning out of their bottoms.
Yes.
When the scopes came out of the bottoms, did Desai take the scope out differently than the other doctors did?
At times, yes.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, once in a while we would get a patient that, you know, wasn't doing that well and might have a slow pulse or a bradycardia or something, he would whip it out in a big hurry.
So he would just yank the scope out?
Yes.
When you yank the scope out of somebody, what would happen?
Whatever was in it was flying around the room and on me and everyone else that was in the room.
So you actually got fecal material on you from him yanking a scope out of a person?
Many times.
Did it ever hit any other place in the room beside the people?
Yeah, on the walls. I've seen it on the ceiling, floor.
He said Dr. Desai would often check the waste containers to make sure they weren't throwing anything away that could be reused, including partial bottles of propofol.
When Desai came into a room, did he ever go over to the sharps container and look around inside the sharps container?
Yes.
Do you know why he did that?
Looking to see if we'd thrown anything away that we shouldn't have.
You mean like what?
Excessive propofol or something like that.
So if you had discarded a partial bottle of propofol and he saw it in there, what would happen?
Probably gotten fired.
Did he ever yell at you for doing that kind of thing?
Yes.
Did you employ some mechanism when you actually wasted him? You didn't want to use the propofol on another patient so that he didn't see that?
Yes, I usually tried to squirt it into a wastebasket, just the liquid itself, you know, so that he wouldn't see that it was being wasted.
Did he ever watch what was in your syringes or in the bottles? Or did he pay attention to what was going on over there with the propofol?
All the time.
After Mathis's testimony, another one of the center's victims, Patty Aspinwall, then took the stand. Her doctor referred her to the endoscopy center, and so she scheduled a colonoscopy there in September of 2007. She said her appointment was at 9:15 a.m. She got there around 9, filled out her paperwork, and then sat in the waiting room, which was so crowded that it shortly became standing room only. She said she waited and waited. Her husband needed to be at work at noon, so she kept asking the front desk how much longer it would be. Any time now, they kept telling her. They finally came and got her around 11:30 and took her back for her procedure. She doesn't remember the procedure, but when she woke up, she was in a room alone. And when she was given the results of her colonoscopy, which were that some polyps had been removed and that she likely had irritable bowel syndrome, she noticed something strange.
When the nurse came out to get me, or the woman who gave me my results, I realized I didn't have a voice. I couldn't talk. It was like I woke up with this voice, and I woke up with a laryngitis. I wasn't sick when I went in, but I was. It's almost like I was sick when I came out.
A few weeks later, she noticed that her urine was brown, so she went to the doctor. He gave her some antibiotics, but it seemed to be getting worse. Then one morning, she got up and she was yellow. She also had weakness in her legs, nausea, and her joints hurt. She went back to the doctor and they referred her to the hospital to get some tests done. They admitted her and said there was something wrong with her liver, although they weren't sure what. Then the doctor there started asking her really personal questions and told her that she has hepatitis C, which she was shocked by. But in follow-up appointments with doctors from the endoscopy clinic, they told her that she didn't have hepatitis C. She later received a phone call from the CDC telling her that she had, in fact, contracted hepatitis C and that she had gotten it from the endoscopy center. She told the jury that she's better now. She no longer has any symptoms, but she has to get blood tests done every 6 months because it's still in her bloodstream. Another victim, Sonia Rivera, testified via a Spanish interpreter. She told the court that after she was diagnosed, the first months were really tough. She said she was depressed, tired, she would cry a lot, and her head would hurt. She said everything changed. Gwendolyn Martin testified that after she had two procedures done at the endoscopy center in September of 2007, she too started experiencing flu-like symptoms afterwards. She said she felt tired, her urine got very dark, she had no appetite, and she developed jaundice. She ended up going to the emergency room. They took her blood, and before the evening was over, told her that she had acute hepatitis C. After her diagnosis, she underwent treatment where she took 5 tablets a day and got 1 shot a week for 48 weeks. She then experienced side effects from the treatment, including depression, loss of muscle mass, confusion, and a bad memory. She said it was very frightening and that she still experiences side effects now. Josh Cavett testified that he worked as a gastrointestinal technician, or GI tech, at the endoscopy center for about 1 year and 3 months, right up until it closed. He said he assisted the physicians with the procedures and also worked in the sterilization room, where the equipment used in the procedures would be cleaned. He described how he would scrub the colonoscopy scopes until the feces came out, and then he would put them into a cleaning machine. He also did the same for the bite blocks, which were used in patients' mouths for the upper endoscopies. He was asked if there was ever a time when the cleaning machine wasn't working, and he said yes, that it happened a few times while he worked there. When that happened, they would put the scopes used during the colonoscopies and the bite blocks used in the upper endoscopies in the same cleansing bin to soak.
What would be the cleanliness of the solution? Can you describe that for us after it got to that point? And we're talking 6-8 scopes.
Well, you mean if it was dirty?
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Why would you change it?
I think he's asking how dirty would it be.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, it'd be pretty dirty. I mean, there would be fecal matter all around it, just floating.
Okay, and that's what these things would go in also, right?
Yes, sir.
Cavett said when he would clean the scopes, he would make sure there was no fecal matter in them, but he wasn't sure what other technicians did. He was asked about the bite blocks and in a typical day how many they used. He said they were only allowed so many, and they would clean and reuse them frequently throughout the day. They would only be discarded at the end of the day, so they were used multiple times, even though bite blocks are supposed to be single use only. As for propofol, he said the same bottle of propofol would be used on different patients until it was gone. Daniel Sukdeo was another GI tech who worked at the endoscopy center. He described in more detail the process of cleaning the scopes. He told the jury that the cleaning solution was changed after every 3 or 4 scopes. He said there would be excess KY jelly, fecal matter, and blood from all the different scopes in the solution. After 3 or 4 scopes, he would pour the solution into the sink and refill it with water from the hose. He would then put the scopes in a second bucket and then put them in the cleaning machine. After that, he would dry them off and hang them up. He said he would use test strips every so often to check the cleaning machine fluid, but he said he never changed that fluid himself. He was there when the CDC came in to check out their facilities in 2008, after the outbreak. He said afterwards he was told to clean out the water after every scope instead of every 3 or 4. Occasionally, he said doctors might ask him to flush out the scopes during the colonoscopies while they were inside a patient. He would use a syringe filled with water to flush them out. He said he did not change out the syringe between each patient and would usually just use 1 syringe per day.
So you were dealing, you were talking about patients, 60, 70 patients a day on average. Would you be primarily in one room or both rooms?
Normally I'd be in just one room.
Would you ever take a syringe from one room to another room?
No, sir.
So that syringe would be used by all patients coming through there in a single day?
Yes, sir.
Were there also little basins that the water would be put into to draw up for the flushing?
Yes, sir.
Would those be used all throughout the day as well?
Basins, yes.
Okay, so the basin and the syringe combination, basically one for the whole day?
Yes, sir.
Did you ever ask why that was, or did anybody ever say?
No, I never asked.
Sukdeo said he was also responsible for stocking supplies. He explained that 4x4s were small gauze pads that were used to put the KY jelly on and also used as a grip for the scopes. He said Dr. Desai wanted to limit them and would only allow him to use just one. With the KY jelly, Dr. Desai wanted him to use a very small amount for each patient, a dime-sized dollop of the KY jelly for the colonoscopies. He said at one point, Dr. Desai scolded him after he threw away a tube that still had a little jelly in it. Dr. Desai even showed him how to squeeze the last drops out. He was then shown a photo of a bite block, which goes inside the patient's mouth, and he explained to the court that they were not reusable. But he said they were instructed to go ahead and reuse them, and so they did. He estimated that they would only open a new one about 3 or 4 times a day. And as for how he cleaned them, he said they would be placed in the same bin and the same solution as the colonoscopy scopes. So again, both scopes for the colonoscopies and for the endoscopies went into the same container as the bite blocks. We'll get into more trial testimony right after this quick break from today's sponsors. Effective, natural skincare products without harsh chemicals and sketchy ingredients are essential. With Procure, you can feel better about feeling better. Procure makes guilt-free formulas that really work and that you can trust. Their products are powered by science and enriched with nature. They only use ingredients that heal from proven remedies and natural botanicals. Procure has cleaned up their products. That means no parabens, alcohol, petrolatum, or fragrance. Procure's hydrocortisone cream with calendula is fast-acting, healing itchy, irritated skin with maximum strength 1% cortisone. It's enhanced with organic calendula extracts, a natural botanical that has been used for centuries to reduce inflammation. It gives you all the medicine you need, plus skin-loving ingredients like organic coconut oil. I'm one of those unlucky few whose skin gets a little irritated whenever I wear certain jewelry. So I tried ProCure, and it really helped. The cream goes on really smoothly, doesn't leave any residue, and best of all, there's no funky smell to it. Try ProCure Hydrocortisone Cream with Calendula and get a special $3 discount on Amazon using the code 3JUNKIE. Just go to ProcureHeals.com/junkie to be directed to Amazon, where you'll get a special $3 discount with the code 3JUNKIE. That's the number 3 plus junkie, all one word, and make sure you type it in caps. ProcureHeals.com/junkie, code 3JUNKIE. I'll include the link in my show notes. What would you do to stay alive? Would you wade through snake-infested water? Would you drink your own urine? Would you cut off your own arm? When the stakes are life and death, you might be surprised at the lengths you'd go to save yourself. Every Monday, the Parcast Network's podcast, Survival, demonstrates the human spirit's ability to triumph over deadly adversity with high-intensity stories of people in life-or-death situations. You'll hear about a pilot and passenger crash-landing in the Canadian Yukon in the dead of winter, a man escaping from a North Korean internment camp, people trapped on sinking ships, and the strategies they use to survive, not to mention the lasting psychological effects of living through a traumatic event. Survival. How far would you go to stay alive? Search for and subscribe to Survival wherever you listen to Parcast shows. And don't forget to rate, review, and tell them I sent you. Dr. Clifford Carroll, a former partner at Dr. Desai's centers, also testified about the center's less than ideal conditions under Dr. Desai. Dr. Carroll was testifying in the trial in exchange for immunity. Dr. Carroll told the court that the endoscopy center mostly did endoscopy procedures and colonoscopies. He described an upper endoscopy as when a long, thin camera goes down a patient's throat to the stomach and intestines looking for diseases. A colonoscopy, he said, is where the scope goes through the rectum, guided through twists and turns of the colon, looking for polyps, cancer, or other diseases. He said the average time for an upper endoscopy would be 3 to 5 minutes, and although the colonoscopy time can vary, he estimated 10 to 15 minutes for those. When asked if he had ever heard of the physicians bragging about how fast they could do the procedures, he said Dr. Desai bragged that he was very, very good and could do it faster than anybody. Dr. Carroll told the jury that he's very familiar with hepatitis C and that he actually treats patients with it. He said the treatment for hepatitis C has some major side effects, including mood swings, joint and muscle aches, shortness of breath, and even suicidal thoughts. Some patients get them so badly, he said, that they can't continue the therapy. Dr. Carroll told the court that there was a time when Dr. Desai asked him to take over running the endoscopy center for a period of 6 months. Dr. Desai had suffered from strokes and was going to take time off to recover. Prior to that, he said he did have concerns about the way the center was run, particularly about the number of patients coming in each day. The very day he took over, Dr. Carroll told the nurse manager that he wanted no more than 60 patients scheduled a day, knowing that there's usually about 10 to 12 no-shows per day. He also made the forms easier to fill out, so the process to see the doctor was better. He said the patients were happier and the staff was less stressed. But just 2 weeks later, Dr. Desai came back to the office to check on things, and he wasn't happy when Dr. Carroll told him about the new 60-patient rule he had instated.
Well, his response, he got angry at me. He was sitting at his desk. He was very upset with me. And he said, "You don't do anything without passing it through me first."
He said after Dr. Desai scolded him, the patient count went up again. Dr. Carroll testified that there were times when Dr. Desai would actually interrupt him when he was seeing patients and would tell him to do endoscopies on them right then and there without scheduling them and without allowing them to fast beforehand, just so Dr. Desai could get his numbers up.
So sometimes when I was seeing patients on the medical side in the room, the door closed, interviewing the patient, sometimes there would be a knock at the door, and Dr. Desai would be there, and he'd open the door, and he'd say to me, and he needs more EGDs, or upper scopes, to be done at the center next door, which meant he wanted patients right then and there to have their procedures that day, rather than get scheduled for another time. Sometimes he would say, I need 5 or I need 10 more EGDs, because he was concerned that the schedule number had fallen to a level that he didn't like. That happened on many occasions.
He said if a patient has any food in their stomach prior to 8 hours before the endoscopy procedure, that could lead to the patient vomiting and aspirating, which is when the patient vomits and then swallows it into the lungs, which can then cause breathing issues or lead to pneumonia. Dr. Carroll then explained how he became concerned about another issue at the clinic. He said that in 2005, a man named Kevin Rexford sued him and Ronald Lakeman for malpractice. At one point in February 2008, as that lawsuit was still going on, he received a concerning phone call from his attorney, who told him that during one of the depositions, it came out that the insurance company had been inaccurately billed during the procedure for the anesthesia. The bill was for over 30 minutes, way longer than it should be. He talked to Dr. Desai about it and asked if there was a billing problem, but Dr. Desai assured him that there wasn't. About a week and a half later, another issue came up in the lawsuit, and so he went to Dr. Desai again.
There had come a written request into the office that was shown to me by the attorney representing Mr. Rexford, that he wanted us to send him all the anesthesia sheets, all the records, including the anesthesia sheets for the anesthesiologist. The nurse anesthetist records the vital signs and the patient's experience. He wanted all of those from that day in 2005 to be sent to his office for review. So I went to Dr. Desai and I asked again that this is what's happened. This is the request, and why would this request be made? Why is the attorney so interested in the anesthesia sheet? And again, I said, is there a billing fraud? And he said to me, there is no billing fraud.
And you just quoted his words, is that right?
Correct.
Did he actually use the word fraud?
Yes.
He said he took Dr. Desai at his word. About a week later, he was about to do an upper endoscopy procedure on a patient who was about to be sedated. He noticed that the nurse anesthetist had written down the start and finish time for the anesthesia before the patient was even injected. He said they had written down 31 minutes, which again would be longer than the amount of time the patient would actually be under. After the procedure, he said he went right to Dr. Desai's office and told him that the end times for the anesthesia must be the actual end times, and Dr. Desai said okay. He then told him that he could tell the manager to tell the anesthetist to make sure the numbers were correct. Later, he saw the anesthesia records and they seemed to be more accurate. He said he began to look at the records from before to see if he could understand what had been going on with the timing on the anesthesia sheets. Every single sheet he examined had the time listed as more than 30 minutes. He said he was very concerned, but by this time, the practice was already being shut down. He said he did meet up with Dr. Desai once after everything went down. He said they talked about why there was a criminal investigation, and he asked why the anesthetist would always put down more than 30 minutes on their anesthesia sheets. He said Dr. Desai told him that that's how long it used to take, back when they were a smaller clinic. He said that must have just carried over from then. Dr. Carroll testified that when the CDC and health department came in and told them that there had been a hepatitis C transmission from their center, he was shocked. And that's when he learned their theory on how the hepatitis C may have been transmitted.
Now, when they came in and they evaluated everything, we had a meeting with the representatives from the health district and the CDC in Tanya's office, for them to tell us what they had been observing and what they were seeing. And Brian Latus said to me with Tanya in Tanya's office that he had observed one of the CRNAs taking a needle off the syringe and putting a new needle on and then going back into the propofol to give sedation. And that those propofol bottles were being used for the next patient if they weren't exhausted. So it's the first time I ever heard of that. So I asked him if he was sure. Are you sure that's what you saw? He said, yes, and that's a possible way that this could have happened through backwash by changing the needle and have the virus was backwashing into the syringe and then passing it on to the next patient.
He said after that, he instituted a policy on how exactly to give injections and made all the anesthetists sign off on it. But immediately afterwards, he saw that one of the anesthetists wasn't discarding the unused propofol from the bottle, but instead was saving it for the next patient. He said he got permission from Dr. Desai to fire her, but he found out later that Dr. Desai had overrode that decision and decided that she could stay. He said this was right after the outbreak was discovered, but before the public announcement was made, so they were still practicing. When asked to describe Dr. Desai's management style, he said he oversaw every aspect of the practice and was very concerned with every layer of operation at all times. When asked if Dr. Desai was concerned about costs and supply usage, he said yes, and even described how Dr. Desai would scold him over changing out his gowns after procedures.
Sometimes he would make an off-the-cuff remark about me wearing this white gown during procedures. So when we do procedures, we wear a gown. It could be blue, it could be white. We had white gowns with little snaps in the front. And sometimes those gowns would have material, pieces of liquids or even pieces of liquid stool on the gown that has to be thrown away. Or if we did an upper endoscopy, there'd be nothing on the gown, because nothing happens during an upper endoscopy. Sometimes he would admonish me that if every time I change one of those gowns, it costs $5. And you shouldn't do that.
So you wanted to change, was it your practice to change between patients?
It was my practice to change when it was necessary. I didn't change after an upper scope, but generally after each colonoscopy, I would change. Or if it was a particularly clean and easy colonoscopy, I might not, because nothing happened to my gown.
The
gowns thrown away and discarded.
Okay.
They're disposable. But when it came time to throw it away, I would throw it away.
But he gave you a hard time about that.
Yeah, he admonished me for that.
On cross-examination, Dr. Carroll spoke more about hepatitis C statistics in the country. He told the court that 2% of Americans carry the virus, and that most of them are from the baby boomer generation, those who were born between 1945 and 1965. He pointed to the combination of crazy behavior in the 60s and 70s and the lack of knowledge about surgical procedures. Dr. Carroll also informed the jury that prior to finding out about the outbreak in October 2007, the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare inspected the center and awarded it with the highest rating. He said they called it a model unit and that the inspection was thorough and detailed. Dr. Carroll also told the court that he never believed the center was responsible for the outbreak. He said he was shocked because he had never heard of a transmission in an endoscopy center before. He said after the outbreak, he wanted to understand for himself how this happened and if it was true. So he gathered all the names of the patients who were on the schedule on the days they were infected. That's when he said he started to notice some problems in the way the CDC and health district were saying it had spread.
The cause of concern at that time was that at the time there were patients between patients that had an infection that, to my knowledge at the time, were not infected, were not recognized as having hepatitis C. There were a number of patients between the infected patients who were not. And that seemed odd for this proposed mechanism. And I began to figure out by who the CRNA was, because it was listed in our schedule, I began to separate out the two rooms by the CRNAs and began to understand that it seemed that there were infections in two rooms. And I couldn't understand by what the mechanism that was proposed. At the time, I didn't understand how it could go from one room to the other.
Richard Wright, the attorney for Dr. Desai, pointed out that the majority of the center's patients were baby boomers, and Dr. Carroll agreed that they could have had hepatitis C before receiving treatment there. Dr. Vishinder Sharma, another doctor who worked with Dr. Desai, testified that he, too, doesn't believe that the outbreak spread through the propofol vials. He said he never saw any nurse anesthetist reusing vials of propofol, although he admitted the room was dark when he was doing the procedures. He said his theory on the outbreak is that it could be blamed on the reuse of saline bottles in the pre- and post-operation rooms. Dr. Sharma agreed with the prior witnesses that Dr. Desai was concerned with cutting costs, but he said that it wasn't at the expense of the patient's safety. Dr. Eladio Carrera, another doctor who was receiving immunity in exchange for his testimony, testified that Dr. Desai was cheap when it came to equipment and anesthesia. He recalled during one procedure, Ronald Lakeman, the nurse anesthetist, almost refused to give a patient more propofol at Dr. Desai's instruction.
I was doing a procedure, and in my usual routine of looking at the patient from time to time, it seemed to me the patient might be uncomfortable. And I asked Mr. Lakeman if the patient could safely get more propofol. And his comment to me was that Dr. Desai did not want them giving more than 200 milligrams of propofol to any one patient.
And what did you say?
I said, Ron, if that doesn't really matter, if the patient needs more medication, he should get more medicine. And he said, fine, and he administered more medication to the patient.
He said Dr. Desai often berated him about how long it took him to do his procedures, even calling him out in front of everyone in their staff meetings. Dr. Desai would also tell him that he was using too many protective masks, that he should just use one per day, too much lubricant on scopes, and too many coats. He said he told Dr. Desai that if his coat was very soiled, he was going to change it, and that was that. Maggie Martin, a registered nurse who worked at the endoscopy center, said she talked to the manager, administrator, and to Dr. Desai about her concerns that the patients were moving through the center too quickly. She said Dr. Desai didn't say anything back to her. She said she and her colleagues brought it up at staff meetings too. She said they were scared for patient safety. Their main fear was that maybe the scope would perforate the colon of a patient, but she said they had no idea that there would be a hepatitis C outbreak. She recalled how one night they held a special dinner to celebrate the fact that they had performed 1,000 procedures in a single month. She said Dr. Desai was the quickest at his procedures and that he often bragged about it. He would do a colonoscopy in about 5 minutes and an upper endoscopy in 2 or 3 minutes. The other doctors would take about 15 minutes for a colonoscopy. She also testified that sometimes Dr. Desai would start a colonoscopy before the patient was given anesthesia. She estimated he did this about 2 or 3 times a week. She said they were so busy getting patients in and out that sometimes the patient wouldn't even be quite asleep yet, but the procedure would start anyway. She also reiterated earlier testimony that Dr. Desai would often tell the nurse anesthetist not to give the patients any more propofol, even if they were moving around or moaning during the procedures. And not only did Dr. Desai tell them to cut the pads that went underneath the patients in half so they could reuse them, he also wouldn't allow them to place sheets over patients in the event that they were cold. She said if Dr. Desai saw a sheet on a patient, he would grab it off of them and fold it back up. The nurse who had given out the sheet would then be reprimanded. Marion Van Druff, another GI tech, said he would often assist in the procedure rooms and worked with every doctor in the center, including Dr. Desai. He also worked with Ronald Lakeman. When asked if there was a difference from when he assisted Dr. Desai to other doctors, he said yes. He said Dr. Desai was quicker with his procedures and more aggressive. He said typically when a scope is pulled out of a patient after a colonoscopy, he would immediately then take it to be cleaned, but it was hard to immediately get it with Dr. Desai because he was so aggressive when pulling it out.
It was most people on the floor would say the same thing, that whenever it came to him removing the scope, it was almost like cracking a whip.
Was that a term that you used?
Yes.
You and the other techs as well?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me. When you say cracking the whip, is that like snapping it out kind of thing or what?
Yeah.
When that would occur, what would happen as far as the scopes when they came out, did they have fecal material and things on them?
Yes, they did.
What would happen when he would crack the whip, so to speak, in those instances?
Depending on how
messy, I guess you would say, that the procedure was, whether or not if they were actually clean enough from prep. It would actually happen that fecal matter would follow the scope and possibly splatter onto the procedure table or the bed, on protective garments, and sometimes even on the wall and floor.
A registered nurse named Karen Peterson testified that she was so concerned about the center's practices that she quit after having worked there for just one day in April of 2007. Having been a nurse for 45 years, she said she saw things there that she had never seen before at any other centers she had ever worked at. She recalled that after a patient colonoscopy, she noticed that the syringe that was used was not discarded or sterilized.
When the procedure was over and the patient was moved out, I told the technician that was working that day that the tray was contaminated, and she said, "That's okay." And the nurse anesthetist said to me, in quotes, "That's the way they do it here."
Well, how did that have an effect on you when you heard that?
It did. I just couldn't believe it.
She said she was also taken aback at how the nurses would fill out the start and end times for the procedures, even before the patient left the procedure room. She said the times were not accurate, and it bothered her that they were doing that. She said she was upset and didn't feel that the healthcare at the center was up to par. So she called her boss the next day and told her that she couldn't come in because she had issues with the center. She explained what her issues were, and her boss told her that she was unaware of it and would look into it. Vincent Mioni, a nurse anesthetist who had also signed an immunity agreement, testified that the center moved patients through so quickly that many times the patients would still be connected to the oxygen when they were being wheeled out. Sometimes they had to shout that the patient still had to be disconnected. Mioni also corroborated the testimony about putting down inaccurate times on the anesthesia sheets. The actual times would be about 15 to 20 minutes, but they were always instructed to write down more than 30. As for why, he said he was told that the insurance companies wouldn't pay unless it was over 30 minutes. Mioni also testified that he never gave open vials of propofol to another nurse. But Ralph McDowell, another anesthetist, testified that he and Mioni often brought each other containers that had already been used, but he said that he would discard them because he thought the vials shouldn't be open for more than 10 minutes in case a chemical reaction occurred that would make it unsafe. He testified that the same propofol vial could be used on different patients if the nurse changes out the needle and the syringe each time they use it. He said he had worked at clinics before that would have a large vial of propofol that they would withdraw from. He also testified that at one point, a patient started to wake up halfway through the procedure. He went to give him more propofol, but Dr. Desai stopped him and told him that he was finished. He said he wasn't expecting Dr. Desai to be done that quickly and believed he was only halfway through. Vincent Sagendorf said he started working at the endoscopy center in October of 2007, shortly after they had received that high grading from the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare. But he said he was surprised at the grade because he immediately saw what he said were big things that were missed, including patient care issues. He said he didn't find it odd that the nurse anesthetist would use one bottle of propofol on numerous patients. He said that's something that is done around the world. He said he used a new syringe and new needle each time, regardless of whether it was the same patient or a new one. However, he did say that open vials of propofol were brought into examination rooms. As for the anesthesia times that they were instructed to fill in, he said that was strange to him. He testified that Keith Mathis had told him that Dr. Desai wanted the anesthesia times to be more than 30 minutes. He knew that was for insurance purposes, to collect insurance money, but he still obeyed. He said he felt like he was caught between a rock and a hard place because he needed to keep his job. Dr. Melissa Schaefer, with the Center for Disease Control, testified that she believed that the hepatitis C was spread due to the center's injection practices. She said the injections contaminated the bottles of propofol that were then used on multiple patients. She described how she went to the center after the outbreak and watched as the doctors did multiple procedures. She saw numerous issues, including the issue of using one vial of propofol on multiple patients. And she explained to the jury why this is a dangerous practice.
Now, are you personally, I mean, as a physician, familiar with that drug?
Yes.
Is that in your stint in the ER that you used that drug or were familiar with it there?
I did use it in the ER, yes.
You say that it's single patient use only. Is there a reason why?
Does it have a preservative or a bacteriostatic, a preservative that essentially makes sure that bacteria can't multiply in there. They call it milk of anesthesia because...
Say that again.
Milk of anesthesia. It looks like milk. It's a white, opaque liquid. There's concern for bacterial growth that can happen in there if it's used serially for multiple patients going in and out of it over a long period of time.
And that's just bacterial infection, correct?
Right.
But do I understand you correctly that the bottles themselves say single patient use only?
Yes.
Something to that effect?
Yeah. Yes.
And is that generally known?
Yes.
She also saw that they would pool together multiple vials of unused propofol to get another dose out of it.
Was that a concern, that kind of activity?
Yes. I mean, along the same lines, if they're using propofol for multiple, or she's using propofol for multiple patients, and then some of these vials are sitting open for some period of time, and then we're pooling. So if one vial gets contaminated, you can perpetuate if I go into the next vial and don't use all of that. Like, you can move your vial to vial.
She said she interviewed Ronald Lakeman by phone, who by that time had left the center and was working in Atlanta. She said she asked if he had ever used the same syringe to get propofol out of an open bottle, and he said yes. She said he acknowledged that it wasn't a safe practice and told her that he was also concerned about the way the scopes were cleaned, that sometimes they were just cleaned with soap and water and not properly sterilized. While they were talking, she said he expressed concerns about her recording the phone call. She told him that she wasn't, but that she was taking notes. She said it was a public health investigation, not a criminal matter at that time. He told her that he would talk to her, but that if it ever went public, he would deny ever saying anything. Brian Labus, the senior epidemiologist who authored the final report on the hepatitis C outbreak, reiterated to the jury his conclusion.
What was that conclusion?
That the reuse of propofol vials for multiple patients and the reuse of syringes to access those vials for an individual patient provided the greatest risk of transmission of blood-borne pathogens between patients.
After the state rested, Richard Wright, the attorney for Dr. Desai, published an exhibit for the jury. It was the resolution of the civil cases the family of the deceased victim, Rudolfo Miana, had against various individuals. He said the Miana family received a total of $2.3 million. The defense, both Dr. Desai's and Ronald Lakeman's combined, called just two witnesses to the stand. The first was Dorothy Sims, a state health inspector who also was involved in the investigation of the center. She testified that she did see a nurse anesthetist reuse syringes, but that she did not tell the nurse that it could put patients at risk. She said that she considered the center's procedure safe, but not the best practice. Dr. Howard Workman, a liver specialist from Columbia University, testified that it was extremely unlikely that Rudolfo Miana died from hepatitis C. He said there were several factors that contributed to his death that he had prior to his colonoscopy.
There were a couple medical problems that were concerning and probably played a factor over the next few years. One is he had hypertension that was being treated. Another condition he had was benign prostatic hypertrophy, which is an enlargement of the prostate gland that seemed to be causing urinary obstruction. So the urine wasn't flowing properly and it may have been increasing the pressure in the kidneys. So I noticed, for one thing, two things that were affecting his kidneys prior to then. And I also noticed on a CT scan that I believe he had in June of 2007, there were a couple of liver findings, and one in particular was dilated extrahepatic bile ducts. So the bile ducts that take the bile from the liver to the intestine were abnormally dilated. And I noted he had also had his gallbladder removed at some time prior to that, so suggesting that there had been and might have still been some low-grade obstruction of the bile ducts in Mr. Mann.
In their closing arguments, prosecutor Pam Weckerly said that greed caused Dr. Desai to gamble with patients' lives. But she also spoke about how Ronald Lakeman is responsible, too, because he was the person who injected both source patients on the days the outbreaks occurred. She said people who go in for routine colonoscopies shouldn't come out with diseases. She said they knew better at the center and that they should both be held accountable. Dr. Desai's attorney, Richard Wright, said that Dr. Desai was frugal, but that he didn't hatch a scheme to deliberately infect his patients with hepatitis C. He said none of the state's witnesses could say for sure how the virus was transmitted, and that they couldn't prove that Dr. Desai nor Ronald Lakeman knew that they were risking their patients' healths. He then addressed the fact that many of the state's witnesses had testified with immunity, saying that if you pressure people hard enough, they'll come up with a story. Lakeman's attorney, Rick Santacroce, called Lakeman a sacrificial lamb and said that the public is just clamoring for someone to blame for the infections. He said the state failed miserably to prove Lakeman's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. When the jury came back from their deliberations, they found Dr. Desai guilty of second-degree murder and 26 other counts. They found Ronald Lakeman not guilty of second-degree murder, but guilty on 16 other counts. In October of 2013, Dr. Desai was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility for parole after 18 years. Judge Valerie Adair said there was no worse betrayal of trust than what Dr. Desai did to his patients. Ronald Lakeman was sentenced to 8 to 21 years. And Keith Mathis, who had pleaded guilty to 5 charges, was sentenced to 28 to 72 months. Meanwhile, another infected patient, Michael Washington, died in August of 2013, shortly after the trial concluded. Prosecutors were reportedly deciding whether to charge Dr. Desai and Lakeman with his death, too. Dr. Desai, along with his former clinic manager, Tanya Rushing, were also charged in a federal case alleging healthcare fraud from when they were overbilling their insurance companies. Tanya Rushing pleaded guilty to one felony count of conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud. She was sentenced to 366 days. Dr. Desai also pleaded guilty to healthcare fraud and healthcare fraud conspiracy. He was sentenced to 71 months in prison, to be served concurrently with his life sentence. At his sentencing, Dr. Desai apologized for what he had done. His attorney later told reporters that he was very remorseful, that he never meant to harm anyone, and that he lives with what happened every day. Dr. Desai appealed his conviction, but in April 2017, at the age of 67, he died of a stroke while in prison. And just 3 months after his death, in July 2017, the Nevada Supreme Court overturned his second-degree murder conviction. In their decision, one of the justices wrote, quote, "Miana did not die as an immediate and direct consequence of Desai's actions." He said Miana's failure to pursue treatment broke that direct causal connection. The decision also reportedly said that because the nurse anesthetists, and not Dr. Desai, administered the injections, Dr. Desai could not be convicted of murder. The court upheld the convictions of the other counts. And that's all for today's episode. I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you agree with the verdicts? Were you surprised that Dr. Desai's second-degree murder conviction was overturned? Let me know by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com, tweeting me at courtjunkiepod, or finding me on Instagram at courtjunkie. As always, if you'd like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, you can do that for as little as $1 a month by signing up at courtjunkie.com/support. That will redirect you to my Patreon page. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.